Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lucy Ash, and here on the BBC World Service, over the next 3 weeks, I'll be giving you the inside story of a decade of war in Iraq. The series begins with the run-up to the US-led invasion, encompasses the birth of a wavering democracy, and the attempts to put an end to the killing that has claimed over 100,000 lives, with victims on both sides. After the multiple terrorist attacks on the 11th of September 2001, which shocked both the US and the world, President George W. Bush made a televised announcement.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
What he called the war on terror had begun. In the days following 9/11, Iraq's intelligence service received a secret message from the US via a trusted emissary, seeking assurance that Iraq would cooperate in the war against terror. Salam al-Jawali was in the Iraqi secret service.
The message said, America wants Iraq to commit to the war on terror against al-Qaeda.
On receiving the letter, Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz gave the order to tell America Iraq would help in the fight against al-Qaeda. Whilst Aziz was issuing this order, Saddam Hussein's secretary phoned to say the president would be replying to the letter himself. His answer was very different.
Saddam Hussein's secretary phoned. He said the president will reply himself. Saddam said, America isn't the only country to suffer terrorism. The sanctions on Iraq are also terrorism.
Saddam went on to add that UN sanctions had killed far more in Iraq than had died in New York on 9/11. The US government was clearly angered by the response.
The Americans replied, Iraq is still playing games. There can be no cooperation between us. So forget it.
By January 2002, the Allies, mainly in the form of US and UK troops, had deposed the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. After the failed attempt to bring the Iraqis on board, US Vice President Dick Cheney turned his attention to the next target.
Another terrorist attack, and everybody was convinced there'd be a follow-on to 9/11, the place where we thought the biggest threat lie was Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
And the British Prime Minister Tony Blair was fully behind the plans for change in the region.
I had taken the view we needed really to remake the Middle East, and therefore in the end you're going to have to go through, I'm afraid, this long and drawn out and sometimes bloody process of transition.
You got to deal with what you got. And anybody basically was better than Saddam Hussein.
Dick Cheney's first call was to the CIA to see if it was possible to avoid war by organising a coup d'etat to overthrow Saddam. Luis Rueda was chief of Iraq operations at the agency.
I explained to him, we have looked at covert action on Iraq for years. We have tried every effort. He has organised his regime to stop exactly that sort of thing, to stop a coup. He has destroyed the opposition. He has destroyed anybody who has the talent to do this. And I said, Mr. Vice President, we can't do a coup. The possibility of overthrowing Saddam Hussein via coup is nil.
Dick Cheney was determined not to make the same mistake he'd made as defence secretary during the first Gulf War. This time around, removal of Saddam Hussein was the only option.
He said, look, we made a mistake last time. We're not going to make this mistake. We're going to correct this mistake this time. I interpret that to mean we stopped short of Baghdad and didn't remove him. We're going to fix that when I remove him.
Removing Saddam inevitably meant war, which would require good intelligence inside Iraq if they had any chance of defeating the regime. The Kurds from the mountainous region in the north had been fighting Saddam for decades. They had long memories back to 1991 and the first Gulf War. President George Bush Sr. made an announcement on Voice of America Radio, urging Iraqis to rise up.
And that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands, to force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside and to comply with the United Nations resolutions and then rejoin the family of peace-loving nations.
But the Americans didn't go all the way to Baghdad. Saddam crushed the rebellion, forcing many Kurds to flee the country. Kurdish political leader Jalal Talabani felt betrayed.
I refused to have any kind of contact with the United States of America. But that time when we, in Iraq, we reached the conclusion that the removal of dictatorship is impossible without the support from outside.
In 2002, the Americans decided to fly the Kurdish leaders to a supposedly clandestine CIA training camp in rural Virginia. Barham Saleh was advisor to Jalal Talabani.
This was supposed to be, A, a secret visit. Secondly, also the location was supposed to be secret. So the windows were closed or taped off. But the navigation maps on the seats were still on, so we knew we were exactly going to land.
The Kurdish leaders had come to meet senior agency officials to see if they could persuade them to help. John McLaughlin, deputy director of the CIA.
We said, in the event the United States embarks on this operation, we're going to need a network of intelligence agents in Iraq. We did not have as robust a network as we would have liked.
The Kurds did. The Kurds had networks. The Kurds had contacts. There were Kurds throughout all of Iraq. And I explained to them that the Kurds are an integral part of this thing. We need you to provide access to intelligence, to provide access to your territory.
The CIA's Luis Rueda. But Kurdish leaders like Massoud Barzani and Barham Saleh needed to be convinced that this time the U.S. was serious about regime change.
Convince us you want regime change. We won't be left stranded again.
We had people explaining on a whiteboard, actually, specifically the times, the dates, the landing of some forces that were to come to the Kurdish areas and so on, that I realized this is, at long last, it is for real. And I remember whispering into the ears of Mr. Talabani, I said, this time you're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
The main fear of Americans like Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz was that Saddam would supply al-Qaeda with chemical, biological and nuclear weapons of mass destruction, WMD.
Iraq had developed chemical weapons and used them. It had developed biological weapons. It had almost gotten to a nuclear weapon before the first Gulf War began. So Iraq was a known quantity when it came to having weapons of mass destruction.
Saddam had already used a chemical weapon, nerve gas, during the Iran-Iraq War, notoriously in 1988, against the Kurds in Halabja, a town bordering Iran. The attack on Halabja killed more than 3,000 Kurds. Thousands more had their health irreparably damaged. In April 2002, at a press conference in Crawford, Texas, with Tony Blair, his closest ally, President Bush laid out his plan.
I explained to the Prime Minister that the policy of my government is the removal of Saddam and that all options are on the table.
The President is right to draw attention to the threat of weapons of mass destruction.
But while George Bush had strong domestic support, Blair's position was much trickier. He was challenged at Prime Minister's question time in the lower house of Parliament.
The Prime Minister will be aware of the concerns throughout the country that by the time this House returns in the autumn, we will be at war with Iraq. Does he? Members may groan, but many millions of people are concerned.
The day before Blair was due to take a summer break, he summoned senior colleagues to Downing Street, including Alastair Campbell, his head of communications.
The head of the Secret Intelligence Service had just been in America, and he was very much of the view that the Americans basically decided this was going to happen. And it was a question of when rather than if.
British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw wanted to be clear exactly why the Prime Minister would commit the country to war.
So I posed the choices. Were we going to support the Americans in their objective of regime change? Or was it about requiring compliance by Saddam of his United Nations obligations to rid himself of his chemical and biological weapons, the weapons of mass destruction?
I said to Jack, the issue was undoubtedly the proliferation of chemical, biological and nuclear weapons. But obviously, the nature of the regime is of some importance when you consider the threat of such a regime having WMDs. So the separation of the two has always been a little unreal.
We could not be involved in any kind of military action, which objective was regime change, because that is unlawful according to our interpretation of international law.
Jack was very clear, I think, that just because the Americans are saying something does not mean the British government have to do it. But Tony was very clear that that would have been a huge break with British foreign policy. And he said directly to Jack, look, this is worse than you think. I actually do believe in this.
Meanwhile in Baghdad, Saddam was meeting with his top people and was clearly in a bullish mood. Saddam had executed many hundreds of officers for telling him things he didn't wish to hear. But one general at the meeting decided to take a risk, Raad al-Hamdani of the elite Republican Guard.
I asked permission to speak. He said, go ahead. Mr. President, we're living in the shadow of a war. He said, what war? I said, the war that will determine our fate. It's approaching fast. I had practiced my speech many times. He pulled out a Cuban cigar and tried to light it. It was damp, so it took a while. He kept those sharp eyes fixed on me. I said, I command an armoured corps. Our weapons are obsolete. We don't have modern air defence systems. We'll be target practice for American pilots.
General al-Hamdani had to wait until the end of the meeting to see if he was to become yet another statistic in Saddam Hussein's brutal record.
He called me over and said, come, stand next to me. Then he turned to me and laughed, just who are you trying to frighten?
Will anyone in humanity benefit if America defeats Iraq? Who will benefit if Iraq's enemies defeat us? Would the American people benefit?
Salam al-Jamali from the Iraqi Secret Service says that Saddam was confident his regime would survive.
The leadership believed America was not serious about regime change. Our regime was opposed to religious extremism. We kept Iran in check, and in our Iraq, not one person belonged to Al-Qaeda.
Commander, how are you?
Good, sir.
We'll see you Friday.
Yes, sir.
In America that summer, the debate over Iraq that mattered was between members of the National Security Team, the so-called Hawks and Doves. Dick Cheney, the vice president, wanted America to act now. Former general and now Secretary of State Colin Powell worried that the president was being steamrolled into war. So he asked the president for a private meeting.
The point I made to him is that I was a little uneasy that all of the briefings the president had been getting with respect to Iraq had been dealing with war plans and how long it takes to get troops there. And I said, we're going to have to do something, either diplomatically or through the use of military force. We're going to need allies. We're going to need people who will support us. And he thought about it for a moment. He said, well, what should we do? And I said, I recommend you take it to the UN. They are the aggrieved party. It's their resolutions that have been offended.
Colin Powell's arguments convinced the president that they should seek a new UN resolution to demand the return of the weapons inspectors whom Saddam had expelled 4 years earlier. But Cheney was not happy and made it clear in public.
The person would be right to question any suggestion that we should just get inspectors back into Iraq and then our worries will be over. Saddam has perfected the game of cheat and retreat and is very skilled in the art of denial and deception.
In his speech, he effectively shot down the proposal, shot down what we were getting ready to do. The UN couldn't do this. It was probably a waste of time. I mean, everything that you shouldn't have said, in my humble judgment, with respect to a decision the president had made.
Colin Powell decided he needed an ally. They were thin on the ground in Washington, so he looked across the Atlantic for help, to Jack Straw, British Foreign Secretary.
Went on Concorde, got a helicopter straight from the side of the plane to the house in which Colin Powell was staying.
Colin Powell was on holiday in the Hamptons, at the home of the cosmetics heir Ron Lauder. After a quick spin in a classic car with their host, the two foreign ministers worked out how they would put together an international coalition against Iraq.
I said to him, unless we go down the UN route, with brackets the possibility that this could be resolved peacefully, the Brits can't be involved, full stop.
The point I made to him is that the vice president always had a reluctance to take what he believed is something for us to decide and sort of take it to the United Nations and get others involved.
President Bush would now have to choose between the doves and the hawks, Colin Powell or Dick Cheney. So he called his team to Camp David, the presidential country retreat north of Washington. If President Bush agreed with Cheney, it would put Tony Blair in an impossible position. Blair asked the president if he could put his point of view face to face. He would fly to the US to do so.
The only way we were going to get the United States back down the United Nations path was by making it clear we were there as allies. You know, we weren't going to be fair-weather friends on this issue, we were going to be with them dealing with it.
President Bush had spent the weekend closeted in Laurel Lodge at Camp David. Tony Blair's arrival interrupted a fierce debate with Dick Cheney.
We went into, there's a small office the president has there at Laurel Lodge, and I can remember the three of us sitting in there talking about this question of United Nations resolution.
I argued very strongly that it was necessary to have that UN support behind us, that we had, because of the seriousness of the consequences of military action, we had to give it one last go at resolving this peacefully.
Another resolution would be passed and would have the same effect as the others. In effect, nothing would happen. I argued that going to the UN was likely to get us all tangled up, and once you pull the trigger and start to move, you've got to move.
President Bush was more in listening mode at that point. But then afterwards, you know, as we were talking together, President Bush made it clear that, on balance, his judgment also was that it was better to have a UN resolution.
Blair had won this battle.
We will work with the UN Security Council for the necessary resolutions. But the purposes of the United States should not be doubted. The Security Council resolutions will be enforced. The just demands of peace and security will be met, or action will be unavoidable.
For Iraq's ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Douri, it was a clear sign of America's intent.
It was a declaration of war against Iraq. So you can imagine, you as a representative of your country, you as a human being, that somebody tell you we will kill you.
Faced with the prospect of war with the US, Iraq's foreign minister, Naji Sabri, decided to speak to Saddam Hussein.
I decided that it is time now to do a preemptive action to stop the United States from this plan of war against Iraq. I sent a coded message to the president proposing approval to let inspectors back.
Saddam Hussein summoned his liaison officer with the inspectors, General Hussam Mohammed Amin, to lay out his orders.
President Saddam Hussein sent for me. He said America and Britain would never be satisfied. They would look for any excuse to go to war. So we must play for time.
Saddam eventually agreed to allow the weapons inspectors back into Iraq. Despite strongly denying possession of any banned weapons, most governments believed Saddam Hussein was lying. At the end of the Gulf War, Iraq had been ordered by the UN to destroy all of its weapons of mass destruction, but it hadn't done so.
We feared an attack by Iran, so we kept some weapons and hid them from the UN. He ordered us to keep no written records. Why? Because documents can leak. A single document could be used as evidence against Iraq.
And Saddam suspected that the Americans had uncovered his deception. So a few months after the war, he ordered the remaining WMD destroyed. Western intelligence agencies had gathered thousands of reports using both human and electronic sources. Most of them pointed to the same conclusion, according to British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
There was a fairly strong flow of information. And of course, all this was against the background of a situation where in the thing that was not in doubt was that he had had WMD and used them.
Don't attack Iraq!
In Britain, opposition to war was growing, and with it, the demand for facts about Saddam's WMD.
We were under enormous pressure to say what we knew from the intelligence we had.
And Tony Blair was asked awkward questions by members of the press in his constituency in northeast England.
We have heard again and again that there is a dossier of evidence about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Why haven't we got it up to now, and when are we going to see it?
I mean, a lot of the work has already been done. There needs to be some more work and some more checking done. But I think probably the best thing to do is to publish that within the next few weeks.
The key thing the security services insisted upon was that the report should be theirs. So I wrote the foreword to it, but the actual report was theirs. The decision as to which intelligence to insert into it was also theirs.
The British Parliament was recalled to debate the report.
Order!
The history of Saddam and weapons of mass destruction is not American or British propaganda. His weapons of mass destruction program is active, detailed and growing.
The Prime Minister then made an astonishing claim based on information received a month before he spoke that never went through the full checking process.
It concludes that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons, which could be activated within 45 minutes, and that he is actively trying to acquire nuclear weapons capability.
The Prime Minister got the headlines he wanted, though he would later regret it.
I have absolutely no doubt if I had my time over again, I would have simply published the intelligence reports that came to me, and then all this stuff about deceit and lies and all the rest of it would have been put to one side.
Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister. Join me in a few minutes here on the BBC World Service for the second part of the programme, as we hear the story of spies and lies which led America to war in Iraq. Hello, I'm Lucy Ash, and welcome back to the Iraq War Regime Change here on the BBC World Service. Throughout 2002, American, British and other Western intelligence agencies had been searching the world for hard evidence that Saddam Hussein still had weapons of mass destruction. Then news came that the French Secret Service had made what looked like a promising breakthrough, as Bill Murray, CIA station chief in Paris, recalls.
I was contacted by my French colleagues, whom I've been working with on counterterrorism matters, and they told me that they had access through an intermediary in Paris to an Iraqi minister very high up in Saddam Hussein's cabinet who may want to defect.
The man was reported to be Naji Sabri, Saddam's foreign minister.
I said it was a long shot, but that it was at least worthwhile following up.
When this message came, we collectively in Iraq operations looked at it and thought there is no reason why the newly minted Iraqi foreign minister would have any information on WMD. Saddam doesn't share it. This guy was not an insider. He was not one of the loyal few.
Luis Rueda, CIA chief of Iraq operations in Washington. He was overruled by his boss, George Tenet, the director of the CIA.
Director Tenet briefed the president on this operation. The president made it clear, said this would be a great coup if we can get him to defect and get up in front of television or the UN and say, we have WMD.
French intelligence had no direct contact with the supposed whistleblower, Foreign Minister Sabri. They were relying on an intermediary, Nabil Moghrabi, a former journalist. He had long been a trusted source for the French intelligence service, says Deputy Director Jean-François Clerc.
Moghrabi, c'est un journaliste, au départ.
Moghrabi was a journalist. He'd been close to the top Iraqis for years. With his excellent contacts, he'd been useful to us for a long time.
Because the expected prize would be so great, the CIA agreed to pay the intermediary $200,000 up front, much more than the normal rate. Foreign Minister Sabri was due to address the United Nations, which gave them a rare chance to get him for a private meeting. Nabil Moghrabi went to New York to see if Sabri would defect or at least answer the CIA's questions about WMD.
I was in New York in mid-September 2002. An Arab ex-journalist living in France telephoned me saying he would like to say hello to me. I said yes. I had suspicions at the time that he has links with the French authorities. I'm not sure.
Sabri agreed to meet Moghrabi at the residence of the Iraqi ambassador to the UN.
He came to me and he started asking me about how I felt about my new job, how I was doing in my, was I happy with it or not. And then he shifted the questions to my relationship with the President Saddam. This was exactly what happened. That's it.
The CIA needed proof that Moghrabi really had met Sabri. Bill Murray, the CIA's man in Paris, prepared a test.
We came up with a little ploy, which was to have the intermediary have a couple of suits custom-made for the minister and to give them to him the night before he spoke at the UN General Assembly and ask the minister to wear one while he was giving the speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, Iraq has always defended the principles and values that...
When I saw the presentation on the TV news later, I was very happy to see that the minister was wearing my suit during his speech to the world. It showed that they had, in fact, met.
Sabri said he wasn't given any suits, but the CIA believed it and debriefed the source, Nabil Moghrabi, on the morning of Sabri's speech to the UN.
The intermediary was able to get detailed answers to the questions that we had posed, the relevant questions on weapons of mass destruction.
The report of the interview was fast-tracked to CIA bosses in Washington, including Deputy Director John McLaughlin.
An important report comes in from a source who claims to have access to the current Iraqi foreign minister, Naji Sabri, that makes quite an impression, particularly on some of the senior people in Washington. People working this problem for him tell him that they can put together a program with nuclear weapons or close to nuclear weapons in 18 to 24 months. The source also says that he has chemical weapons and has mounted them on medium-range launchers as a kind of last resort to use in the event he experiences an invasion or some kind of military action, and that his biological program is not very big but is nascent. Those who had read the Naji Sabri reporting had some confidence that it gave a very reassuring view of Saddam's WMD status. And again, the sensitivity of that and the origin of that was such that you didn't put it out in public. But in the background of things, it strengthened everyone's confidence that what you were saying was accurate.
The report seemed to give high-level confirmation to CIA bosses and the White House that the regime had WMD. But 4 years later, when the US Senate investigated intelligence failures, Murray made a shocking accusation. He said the report of his meeting with Moghrabi had been altered. Murray said Moghrabi had said Saddam had no WMD. But a CIA colleague had changed the report to say the opposite.
The intermediary told me that they were never able to produce a weapons program. There literally were no stockpiles of offensive weapons of mass destruction.
The Senate investigation couldn't find any evidence to support Bill Murray's accusation. And the reason Murray gave for not coming forward with the information for 4 years? He claims he didn't see the report of the meeting at the time of delivery. the CIA were finally able to clear up the matter at the end of the war in 2003, when they were finally able to interview Sabri, as Luis Rueda of the CIA explains.
And he looked at us like we were horses' asses and said, "What defection? What WMD? I don't know what you're talking about." It was a stunning revelation that the source was fabricating this.
Mr. Megrabi declined an invitation to say on the record what he had discussed with Sabri. Today, it's difficult to establish what actually happened and where the information in the report came from. But in the months leading up to the war, the decision makers among the Allies believed that Saddam's foreign minister had confirmed that Iraq had WMD. Blair and US Secretary of State Colin Powell had pushed for a UN resolution, and in November it was passed. The clock for invasion was set ticking. Iraq was given 30 days to prove it had got rid of all its WMD. Iraqi scientists and technicians set out to provide the evidence. General Hussein Mohammed Amin was Iraq's liaison to the UN weapons inspectors.
They worked day and night. We couldn't accommodate everyone. Our office was too small. So we rented a big house nearby for all the scientists working on the report.
The report was 12,000 pages long, but it didn't convince the Americans, according to Stephen Hadley, US Deputy National Security Advisor.
Saddam provides a declaration which is high in volume and shy in content. There's really nothing new. There's nothing that comes close to being a full accounting.
President Bush believed he now had the justification he required to depose Saddam Hussein, but he was worried he hadn't explained the case for going to war. So he summoned Stephen Hadley and John McLaughlin, the deputy director of the CIA, to the White House.
And he asked John McLaughlin to start presenting the intelligence case that Saddam Hussein has unaccounted for weapons of mass destruction.
I said things like, we can document that Saddam has exceeded the UN-imposed limits for the range of his missiles. We had some charts and graphs that showed, particularly for missile testing and such.
And the president, of course, is thinking about how this is going to work in a public audience. And at about 20 minutes in, he stops John and he says, "John, is this the best we can do? Is this the best intelligence case we have?"
It was left to George Tenet, the CIA director, to come to the aid of his deputy.
I can remember the president turned to George, sitting on the couch to the right of the fireplace, where the president and I were sitting on the chairs next to the fireplace. And he asked George, he said, "Just how good is our case on Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction?" And George immediately responded. He said, "It's a slam dunk, Mr. President. It's a slam dunk."
Dick Cheney. The president decided it was necessary to make a legally watertight case for the use of force against Saddam and asked his staff to prepare a brief. The president instructed Colin Powell to present the case. A special session of the UN was convened to hear him. Dick Cheney sent him a draft of the presentation.
I called him and just said, "Look, Colin, I think it's a pretty good package. I hope you'll take a look at it." We weren't trying to, you know, say this is what you've got to use. We were trying to be helpful at the direction of the president.
But Colin Powell was still wary of the Hawks' evidence.
It went first to my assistant, and when he reported to me later in the afternoon that this is not a case, it does not hang together, there is not backup material for the assertions and claims that are made, it's unusable. That was enough for me to call Dr. Rice and say, "Look, we got a problem. All I have is the weapons of mass destruction case. I don't have the human rights case. I don't have the terrorism case. And you need to get more time. We need a little more time." And her answer was, "Geez, sorry, too late. The president has already announced it publicly."
Colin Powell was given a week to prepare for the UN special session. So he went to CIA headquarters to check the facts.
When I went out to the CIA to start working on a new draft of the documentation, the focus was weapons of mass destruction, because that was the cause celebre that would either require us to go to war or not.
and the CIA assured Powell that Saddam was still attempting to obtain nuclear centrifuges and was training al-Qaeda operatives in the use of WMD.
I didn't come up with that information. I spent 4 days sorting through the material to get what I thought was most sustainable. It was attested to by 16 intelligence agencies and British intelligence.
The CIA was confident about its material, including the reporting it believed had come from Iraq's foreign minister, Naji Sabri. However, in order to protect the source, much of it had to be kept secret. Deputy Director John McLaughlin.
The reporting we had that traced to Naji Sabri, along with other reporting we had that was not being declassified, and in some cases has never been declassified, was in the background of people's thinking here. No single report ever takes you to certainty, but it's the kind of report that strengthened the broadly held conviction that Saddam had WMD.
The Secretary of State presented America's case, complete with visual aids.
What you will see is an accumulation of facts and disturbing patterns of behavior. The facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction. Less than a teaspoon of dry anthrax, a little bit...
And with the use of audio.
You will now hear an officer from Republican Guard headquarters issuing an instruction to an officer in the field. This is part and parcel of a policy of evasion and deception that goes back 12 years. Their conversation took place just last week on January 30th.
The senior officer in that bugged conversation was General Rad al-Hamdani of the Republican Guard.
I was surprised when the American minister played a phone call between one of my officers and me. I was talking about discarded weapons from the Iraq-Iran war. He should double-check old chemical weapons launchers to make sure they couldn't be used as evidence against us.
Thousands of troops were deploying to the Middle East in anticipation of war. Paul Wolfowitz, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, said they needed clear orders.
The military worried that if you go through this huge deployment and months go by and then you get into the summer and it's too hot to contemplate military action and you bring people home, this idea that you would keep marching up the hill and then marching back down again was very unpalatable to them.
Public opposition to the war was global. One weekend in February, huge anti-war demonstrations were held in 60 countries. The demonstration in London was the largest in British history, numbering 1 million people. Tony Blair was worried he wouldn't be able to persuade the country that action against Saddam was legal or justified. He needed another resolution from the UN, this one explicitly authorising war. And for that, he had to have the support of Bush and Cheney.
When Prime Minister Blair showed up, he was asking us to do a second resolution. And most of us thought that was not a good idea.
They said, look, we agree with you. We go down the UN route in November. We gave him a final opportunity. He's not taken it. We've got a huge force stacked up, ready to go. And there's a limit to how far we can, you know, the only cooperation we're getting is because that force is there. If you delay and delay and delay, you know, he'll just slip through our fingers again.
The nation expected we were going to act. The Congress had already voted and so forth. And we go back to the UN for another resolution. It looked like a sign of weakness.
It was very hard for President Bush. And you know, he'd already pulled his system down the UN route. But I thought it was important politically still to do it.
The president decided that if Tony Blair needed it for political purposes at home, it was important for us to go the extra mile for our ally.
Deputy U.S. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. The previous UN resolution, which had led Saddam to readmit weapons inspectors, had been passed unanimously. But some members of the Security Council now worried that America was rushing into war. Dominique de Villepin was French foreign minister.
Nous avions absolument besoin que les inspecteurs nous disent la réalité.
To be absolutely clear of the facts, we needed the UN inspectors. What our intelligence services told us just wasn't credible. It certainly wasn't enough for us to go to war against Iraq.
Because France is a permanent member of the Security Council, it could veto the resolution. So could Russia. Russia's leader Vladimir Putin was invited to Paris for a tête-à-tête with French President Jacques Chirac. Maurice Gourdeau-Montagne was the diplomatic advisor to President Chirac.
Le président Chirac et le président Poutine se sont enfermés.
Presidents Chirac and Putin went into Chirac's office. They had a private, secret conversation.
Vladimir Putin and Jacques Chirac agreed they would vote against the war unless the UN weapons inspectors were given time to finish their mission.
The joint position was agreed. If there was a vote without these conditions, we would both veto it.
On the 6th of March, de Villepin had dinner in New York with Colin Powell.
Quand j'arrive devant lui, d'emblée,
when we met, the first thing I said was, it's not up to the USA to judge what's happening on the ground, because they've agreed to trust the UN inspectors to give us that information. It's not up to us to jump the gun and do their work for them. There was a silence. Colin Powell let the silence run on. He raised his head. He looked me in the eye. He said,
ne sous-estime pas notre détermination. Dominic, please, don't underestimate our determination.
3 days later, the French president, Jacques Chirac, startled the world during a television interview.
Ma position, c'est que, quelles que soient les circonstances, la France...
Regardless of the circumstances, France will vote no. France sees nothing at the moment to justify war to disarm Iraq.
But without a second resolution, many of Tony Blair's supporters in government and his Labour Party thought the war would be illegal. Jack Straw believed Blair's own position would be threatened if he supported the Americans without UN cover.
I said to Tony, they are determined to go ahead with this military action, come what may. And there is a grave danger that the only regime change that takes place could be here in this room.
I said, Jack, I know that. I mean, I don't... You know, I'm aware of how tough it is and how much opposition there's going to be to it.
A few hours later, President Bush placed a call.
Good morning, Tony. How are you?
Stephen Hadley, Deputy National Security Advisor.
The President says to him, I know you've got this difficult vote in Parliament. I would rather have you drop out of the coalition and keep you head of your government as an ally than have you try to stay in the coalition and lose your government.
I think he was genuinely trying to reach out to me in a situation of political difficulty, and I made it clear if it was the right thing to do, I wanted my country to be part of it, and I would prefer to have gone and left as Prime Minister than to have backed out on the basis that it was too politically difficult.
And with no likely solution forthcoming from Iraq, President Bush went on television with an ultimatum.
My fellow citizens, events in Iraq have now reached the final days of decision. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing.
In some last-minute lobbying to the British Parliament, the Foreign Secretary used a tried and trusted technique, blame the French.
One of the major arguments I made to Labour MPs was that it was the French who had literally forced us into this position of having to go to war. Because if we'd got that second resolution, there would have been an ultimatum backed by the promise of military action if Saddam had not cooperated. And at that point, he would have cooperated, in my view.
This is not the time to falter. This is the time for this House, not just this government or indeed this Prime Minister, but for this House to give a lead. Yeah. To show at the moment of decision that we have the courage to do the right thing, I beg to move the motion. Yeah.
The British Parliament voted for war. 27 hours remained before George Bush's ultimatum expired. Saddam summoned his military commanders.
War is coming to Iraq. We should not be on the defensive. We will not submit to the tactics of the aggressors.
It became clear during the speech that Saddam's ambitions extended beyond beating the Americans. General Raad al-Hamdani of the Republican Guard.
The president came on stage. He said, the Americans will attack Iraq. They will cross the desert and reach the outskirts of Baghdad. We will bring them to their knees and destroy them. He pointed to us and said, Republican Guard, after destroying the American forces, your mission is to go to Palestine and liberate Jerusalem from Israel. This was a fantasy, a dream. I'll never forget that moment. This was the end of Iraq as we knew it.
More than 200,000 Allied troops were now massing on Iraq's borders. At 2 o'clock on Wednesday, March 19th, 6 hours away from the president's deadline, there was startling news. Luis Rueda, chief of Iraq operations for the CIA.
We had an intel report that came in that said Saddam, that it looked like preparations were being made for a senior level meeting at Dora Farms, and the odds were that Saddam was going to be there.
The CIA had managed to persuade three members of Saddam's security team to spy for them. They were now at Dora Farms, one of Saddam's palaces, on the banks of the Tigris River. They were sending information directly from the palace to Rueda.
Our problem is we don't have a set time. Saddam does not keep a schedule. One of his survival techniques is unpredictability. But based on what we do understand, we believe he will probably be there anywhere between 1 and 3 a.m. And the odds are he will be gone before the sun rises.
This could be an opportunity to both decapitate the regime and avoid a major war. So Luis Rueda and other CIA officials raced to the White House with the news.
I'm grilled by members of the cabinet. How good is the information? As we're doing this, intelligence is starting to flow. More reporting is coming into the Situation Room, and they're bringing it into here. They give it to me, and I start looking at it, and it starts to change and shape the picture.
CIA Director John McLaughlin and his deputy Stephen Hadley take up the story.
John McLaughlin and I are on our knees at a coffee table with maps spread out, trying to take what's coming in from intelligence channels that's a narrative.
We can probably even guess which rooms he may be in this farm complex.
The president's, of course, nightmare is that we conduct a military strike. It's actually a disinformation campaign, and we hit a school bus loaded with children. And that's how the war begins. Not a good way to begin a major military operation.
Faced with a dilemma, Bush turned to the vice president.
Then the president kicked everybody out except me, asked me to stay, and then turned to me and asked me and said, Dick, what do you think we should do? And I basically recommended that I thought we should take the chance that, in fact, Saddam might be there and that it would be a quick and easy way to bring the conflict to an end if, in fact, we could eliminate him in the first hour.
The president decided to strike Dora Farms as soon as the deadline expired.
The initial intelligence reports are encouraging. We're told that somebody who looks like Saddam Hussein has been removed from the rubble. He's blue. And the thought is maybe this has worked. But subsequent reports are less encouraging. And whoever that was that was taken out from the rubble, it was not Saddam Hussein. And this last-ditch effort to head off war has regrettably failed.
Stephen Hadley. In Baghdad, General Raad al-Hamdani, concerned for his Republican Guard troops, requested an urgent meeting with Saddam's son, Qusay.
I said to him, Sir, tell me honestly, do we have WMD? My sector covers 40,000 square kilometers. If we use chemical weapons, they'll blow back onto us. I'm worried our troops will be affected. Qusay smiled and said, Don't worry. We don't have any WMD, not even chemical weapons.
At 5:30 in the morning, Iraqi time, the coalition launched a massive air and land attack on Iraq. War had begun. This programme was a Brooke Lapping production for the BBC. The series producer was Norma Percy. It was produced for radio by Julie Ball. Join me, Lucy Ash, next week for part two in the series Iraq War, After the Fall, how America and Britain quickly won the war but lost the peace.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.